and welcome to the latest edition of the ST Advisor podcast. Today, we are discussing the topic of achieving diversification within a global equity allocation. Advisors have tried for generations to build portfolios with the capacity to perform in all weathers, but with a tiny number of equities having driven the bulk of returns over the past year or so, how can diversification be achieved in the current market conditions? Joining me to discuss the topic are Mark Pedden, Global Equity Income Investor at Aegon, John Moore, Senior Investment Manager at RBC Brewin Dolphin, and Will McIntosh-White, Multi-Asset Investor at Rathbones. Good morning all, and thank you for joining me.
Morning.
John, if we start with you, how do higher government bond yields change the composition of the equity component of an income portfolio?
Thanks, David. I mean, it's funny, at the start of my career, it used to be, you know, bonds for income, equities for growth. You know, in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, low interest rates meant the bonds were for relative safety, for liquidity, and total returns had to be the sort of way that you thought about certain things. That's changed now, and you know, what happens with interest rates, we don't know. Feels like they'll go down, but it feels like income from bonds is now a viable thing again. So what I think that does is it sets a good starting point to the agenda. It means that it takes the pressure off of equity income. And from my point of view, you know, reaching for equity income has been one of the things that's been very tricky, watching some of the problems that have been in high-yielding stocks and high-yielding situations. Really, it's been about trying to get the right balance between income and growth. So high income and bonds just allows that breathing space for equities, for other asset classes, and for probably better total return outcomes.
Thank you. And Will, at Rathbones, how do you think about that question? Is it simply you have fewer equities because you can get the income from bonds, or something else than that?
Yeah, I think definitely it reduces your overall allocation to equities. I mean, for us, the difficulty, as John pointed out, with rates being on the floor for so long, you know, the temptation was to head to equities with high yields. And then, of course, the risk there is actually you're in a bit of a yield trap. And over time, actually, what you see is that dividend get cut, because many of those high-yielding businesses can often be sort of ex-growth. And so that was an unreliable source of income. And so for us, as we went through a period when we had very low yields, we'd actually picked up high coupon bonds. So you sacrifice a little bit of capital in order to generate a sort of consistent level of income. And that gave you the breathing room, even through a lower rate environment, not to have to reach too much for yield. Because as John rightly pointed out, that can end up, you're taking much more risk, you get pushed into the high yield parts of the capital structure in the bonds, and you end up in these very high yielding, unsustainable yielding, really, equities. So that was our strategy. But I think your point there is absolutely right, that you actually don't need too much in the equity pot now to generate that same level of yield that you used to, you know, just 3 years ago.
Thank you. And Mark at Aegon, you're the equity guy around the table, I guess, but how does the composition of your portfolio change or be impacted by government bond yields moving higher?
Hi there, good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to join this podcast. Yeah, I mean, the comments around your question are really referred to within the equity component. I mean, higher rates generally, it's usually advised to avoid highly levered companies with high debt levels for obvious reasons. So you kind of want to stick to companies that have very strong balance sheets. The other point I'd make is you probably want a little less growth exposure, a little bit more value. Classic DCF calculations. We all know that future growth is discounted at the risk-free rate. And as the discount rate goes up, then that future growth becomes less valuable. Within sectors, I would kind of reduce the classic rate sensitive parts of the market. So thinking of sectors like real estate, utility stocks, and an elevated rate environment is actually beneficial for financials. Banks can reprice their loans upwards, and insurance companies, of course, big owners of bond portfolios, they benefit from a better reinvestment rate from their investment portfolios. So that's kind of how we're thinking of playing the higher bond yield environment within our equity fund.
Thank you, Mark. And if we continue with you for the next question, as an equity guy, how do you think about diversification within equity income portfolios? Is geography relevant? Is sector allocation relevant? Is market cap size relevant? What are the considerations there?
I mean, I think all of the above. The first point I would make is that, you know, an appropriate diversification is crucial for any investment solution. You know, that's sort of investment 101. I mean, our fund is invested in over 20 different markets around the world, and we're also invested in all of the gig sectors. So, you know, diversity of market and sector, both very important. What I would say, though, is most important for those investors in our fund that rely on the income stream, it's the diversification of that income stream that is absolutely crucial. We make sure that every single stock we own in the fund contributes to that income stream. There is a big danger for some portfolios that perhaps rely on, you know, a small cohort of very high-yielding stocks. You can come in one day and find that, you know, one of these stocks has made a mega acquisition and actually needs that dividend income to pay for that purchase, and you're left with a huge hole in the income. So I think it's important running an equity income fund that you're not reliant on a few very high-yielding stocks. You actually spread that income stream right across the portfolio.
Thank you. And Will, from your point of view, when you are looking at that equity allocation within a multi-asset fund, what does diversification mean there?
So we invest direct, and we don't really think of it on a geographic basis. Never really matters to us particularly where stocks are listed. There are some tax considerations maybe to consider. So if you're getting a dividend out of a higher tax environment, then obviously that will have an impact. But I think going back to what Mark was saying on diversification by sector in particular is really important, and not being overly reliant on one area for your income. The danger is, of course, is if you head to specific income sectors, you can end up with an undiversified portfolio, because you tend to end up in financials, oils, names like house builders. And if you focus too much on that, you can end up with a high level of cyclicality in the portfolio than you're necessarily looking for. And even then, if you balance it with areas like telcos and utilities, which arguably a bit more defensive, you can still end up with this sort of overall, arguably value bias, if you like. I'm not a big fan of the growth sort of value names, but for us, there is that danger that you get sucked into the same sectors. And actually, given we are a multi-asset portfolio, we can attract income from other parts of the portfolio as well as the equities, and that allows us actually to go into some of those sectors which don't necessarily give you that higher level of income. You know, maybe that's technology, for example, and those type of sectors can be important both from a diversification point of view, but also to help drive the growth of the portfolio, which I think is always the risk when you're in an income portfolio, that actually you end up in these income names. They're paying out nice, healthy dividends, but the capital base isn't growing. And that is so, so important for an income investor in our portfolios.
Thank you. And John, if I understand right, where we'll invest directly, you guys invest in other managers, basically?
So we've got a flexible mandate. We can invest directly. We can invest in collective investments. I think really, I suppose probably what I would say is, if you think about the Magnificent Seven, there's a lot has been mentioned about that. Away from the technology angle, it's really an earnings story. It's about earnings growth, and it's about exceptional earnings growth. And when we try and approach equity allocation, where are we going to get our earnings growth from? Where are the best total returns from? Well, you mentioned, you know, perhaps that's not by geographic bias or by sectorial bias. It's just basically, where are the best opportunities from? I think that's, for me, that's one of the key driving aspects. That's particularly true at times of change, and we're going through a period of enormous change at this point in time. AI is out there, it's a narrative, and it's likely that we're going to get an overspill effect and changes of economic growth and momentum, greater purchasing power for companies, greater purchasing power for individuals. So what opportunities are there for earnings growth as part of that? What opportunities are there for dividend growth as part of that? Does that make sense? So from our point of view, that's where that allocation looks.
Thank you. And Will, how do you view the companies that are invested in doing share buybacks as opposed to dividends? Does it matter from your point of view? Does it matter from your client's point of view?
I guess with my income hat on, because we obviously run a number of strategies, you do prefer to see it in a dividend to a certain extent. But ultimately, you know, we think about capital allocation as we are allocating our clients' capital to management teams when we're investing in businesses, and it's up to them to make sure that they're allocating their capital correctly, right? So I want them investing back in the business if there are, you know, attractive return opportunities by doing so. If you can get a decent return on that capital employed, I'd rather they reinvest back in their business first and foremost and sort of drive that overall growth. And if there is excess free cash flow coming out of the business, do I want it back as a dividend? Do I want it as a buyback? Quite frankly, it kind of depends where the stock is trading. You know, hopefully the business I'm invested in, you know, it's attractive valuation. You know, the sort of intrinsic value is higher than the market value. And if that's the case, you want management teams probably going through buybacks, because essentially they're picking up that business, those shares, you know, below intrinsic value. And that is sort of adding, you know, overall returns as a shareholder. But we do need to see some of that coming out if you're an income share, if you're an income mandate. And so it is a bit of a balance there.
Thank you. And John, does it matter to you, particularly with reference, I suppose, to that income book?
Yeah, I think income's a good discipline for a company to have. It's a check, if checks are still written these days, but it's a check that is, you know, is an ongoing commitment. And I think that capital discipline, well, you mentioned that, I think is important. I also think it's about sort of right-sizing the business. I mean, share buybacks have definitely got their place in certain regions like America. They have got certain tax advantages, so are prioritised over income. But it is about right-sizing the business. If I think about you know, a business like Texas Instruments, which offers, you know, a yield of, say, 3%, that's a business that's retired maybe 40, nearly 50% of its equity count, mm-hmm. but has still managed to pay a dividend. It's right-sized its business in terms of facing into the world that it's in. And that's really what we think about in terms of that capital allocation approach. What is the business doing? What does it face into? What's the right approach for it to sort of change? The opposite side is, you know, and Mark's touched upon this earlier on, acquisitions, the fear of acquisitions. Rekha Benckiser might have that fear more recently. Does that make sense? You know, instead of buying Mead Johnson, if it bought back shares, then perhaps that would have been a better allocation and would have allowed for better dividend growth.
I mean, I guess the other side of that is, how strong is the business opportunities, the growth opportunity for a company, if the best thing they can think to do is buy their own stock? Rather, because they don't have to do acquisition, they could expand in another way, right?
David, I completely agree with you, but it does come down to that thing about timing. Is this? Do you have to do this deal today? Mm-hmm. Does this have to be done? Are you on a path that you feel that you must do things, or really is this something that you can defer? Can you make special dividend payments? Could you do a special buyback at this point in time? Can you keep your shareholders and that capital allocation tense to the point where you see a good opportunity, be that, you know, acquisition, be that an extra dividend, and in that opportunity, make sure that that's key for shareholders? I think we've slightly lost our way with that in certain company allocations, and you can see that playing out over the last 3 or 4 years, I'm afraid.
Thank you. And Mark, as an equity income investor, are buybacks something that you're comfortable with?
I mean, I kind of reiterate a lot of the points that have been made earlier. I mean, I think for us, perhaps a stronger view that we certainly have a preference for dividends over share buybacks. I mean, when we advertise our yield figures for the portfolio, they're very much distribution yields, i.e. exactly the hard cash that our income share class owners actually receive. So certainly a preference for hard cash dividends. The thing as well is, if a company has a solid dividend policy, you know, was touched on before, it's a very good discipline on management allocating their capital effectively. I mean, one thing about company managements is, once they start paying a dividend, they're incredibly reluctant to have to cut it. And invariably, they want to build a strong track record of essentially growing a dividend over time, because that's, you know, a pretty valuable consideration in terms of a stock's valuation. And importantly, puts an important check and balance on management wasting cash on poorly returning projects and various pipe dreams. I mean, share buybacks are no bad thing. We do like them. as long as they are within reason and the balance sheet can accommodate it. Just have to make sure they're not manipulated, obviously. It's a good way to underpin your EPS number, and if management's being incentivized on EPS progression, it can be a crafty way of making sure you get paid. So yeah, share buybacks, we do like them, but certainly a strong preference for hard cash dividends on our part.
Thank you. And John, one of the curiosities of much of the past decade has been that you almost had to choose between owning a stock that could go up in share price terms or one that paid a dividend, right?
Yeah.
A stock that could do both was almost viewed as a rare thing,
yeah,
in many cases, because those technology companies went up a lot and, you know, always had another cracking idea rather than a dividend. But how do you think about, at the portfolio level, that balance between the need for capital growth, which many clients have, particularly as they maybe live longer in retirement, and income yield?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, you know, being a client-centric business, we've got to think about what is it the client wants and how best placed to sort of deal with that challenge. Sometimes that want is a total return that isn't achievable by natural income. David, thinking about the balance you've talked about in terms of the sort of polarization between growth and income, and one might say, you know, growth and value, because sometimes income, well, as you've pointed out, inextricably has value sort of parts to it, particularly if you're reaching for a certain yield. I think one of my key points would be the world that we've entered, higher yields, inflation being robust, but hopefully under control, that's a world where a greater balance will exist. So those extremes of growth and income, I think, were a byproduct of the low interest rate environment that we had that forced that sort of polar opposite situation. I think it's a healthier environment that we're in at this point in time, whereby you can get good returns on cash, you can get good returns on bonds, and really it's about, you know, can I get an extra return on growth or should I get an income, and what's the right difference between the two? So I think it's a really healthy environment that we're in just now, and that's going to last for quite a long time. We're just at the foothills of that change, because really it only started in 2021, 2022.
Thank you. And Mark, as an equity income manager, obviously your clients presumably buy the product with the income bit in mind, but how do you think about that capital appreciation question?
Yeah, I mean, I really do love this question, because it is the crucial consideration for equity income managers. I mean, John makes a great point. This is an incredibly healthy environment for quality income producing companies. You know, the 10 years post the great financial crisis, with rates at zero and inflation non-existent, was a pretty challenging time for this particular asset class. But that was very abnormal. We're now in a far more normal environment. I'm an economist by background, and you know, this, the fact we've got an interest rate cycle and a bit of inflation in the system is a normal environment. We're back to the pre-GFC. In terms of our consideration of the balance between capital growth and income, I think it's important to provide both in a global equity income solution and not sacrifice one over the other, because you end up robbing Peter to essentially pay Paul. What we do is we talk about our sweet spot, and that provides our investors with essentially the optimum combination between premium income and growth. If you go for too low a yield, you can't deliver the premium income stream. If you go for too high a yield, you don't get the growth. So this is why our sweet spot targets the kind of mid-range yield part of the market, let's say between 2% and 4% dividend yields. So we can offer and pay an income stream around about 30% more than the market. We don't want to pay more than that, because you sacrifice growth, and we can grow the capital base consistently and appreciably over time. So I think it's important to provide both.
Thank you. And Will, at Rathbones, how do you think about that balance? I guess one of the big challenges for advisors these days is that clients are probably going to spend longer in retirement. So it's not just a matter of you've got a pot and you clip a bit off it every year. The pot maybe has to grow a little bit as well, unless it's exceptionally large to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you think about the portfolios that we run, often this is investors putting their whole nest egg with us, and that is the part that they need to survive on for the rest of their lives. And so that income needs to be for life. And it just goes back to really the points that we're making around that income target, and it needs to be sensible. And, you know, when we launched our income strategy in 2015, we had a minimum target of 3% yield, which we felt was a level that we could make whatever the weather. And as it turns out, the weather got pretty tough because we went into a low rate environment for a start, or a zero rate environment. And then coupled with COVID, because of course, through that period, you had companies suspending their dividends left, right and centre just in case. And so having that sort of sensible minimum target, I think, is the important starting point. Because, as you say, we had clients before, I'm looking at John, who were sort of demanding, they wanted higher and higher income. They wanted 4 or 5%. And I think you had to have those conversations and say, look, you just can't have that for a sustainable level. Because you could push that. You could push that 4, you could push that 5, but then the capital base started getting eroded. And then in 10, 20 years' time, midway through retirement, you might end up having a difficult conversation because you haven't grown the capital base in real terms. And so you're suddenly having to tell the client that the income that they are receiving is not sufficient to maintain their lifestyle. And so they have to start making cuts. And that's exactly what our clients who are investing in our funds don't want to see. So as I say, I think having a sensible minimum target income, generating that from high quality businesses with sustainable dividends, as well as partly through the bond side, and then making sure that you can grow that capital base to support that.
Thank you. And Mark, how is your allocation to US equities in an income fund right now? It's a well-known story that the US market has done very well, and lots of clients seem to want ever greater exposure to US equities, but it's not traditionally an income market. Is it somewhere where you find opportunities?
Okay, I mean, great question. First point I'd make is you certainly can't ignore the US market in terms of running a global equity mandate. You know, US equities are over 60% of the world's entire market capitalization. I mean, structurally, our sector does tend to underallocate to the US. As you suggested, it's never been a typically attractive market for yield. And with the S&P 500 now yielding less than 1.5%, you can certainly say that, you know, valuations are probably a bit lofty. I don't think they're necessarily challenged, but it's not an obvious market for absolute levels of income. But the US does have the best companies with the best margins and the best returns. So, you know, the US allocation, if you assume ACWI's about 63%, we have 55% invest in the US, so a bit underweight, but still over half the portfolio. And at the end of the day, the point to make about the US market from an income perspective, it does have the best income growth characteristics. I mean, you've probably all heard the phrase dividend aristocrats, companies that have grown the dividend every year for the last quarter of a century. Kings have done likewise for 50 years. Dividend diamonds have done it for 60 consecutive years. And most of these companies are actually US companies. So the US plays an important role in providing that consistent income growth. The final point I'd make is I wouldn't advise you go near the high-yielding stocks in the US. Certainly experience has taught us that a very high yield in the US on an equity is usually a sign of distress and or a challenged business. And, you know, through time, very high dividend-yielding investing really works in that market.
Thank you for that. And John at RBC Brewin Dolphin, I'm remembering the RBC each time now, so I'm getting better. How do you think about allocating to US as a market for in the income book?
I think it's, go back to that point about the Magnificent Seven, it was an earnings story. I mean, the US has been an earnings story, and therefore in the US has had to be a very prominent allocation, because with that earnings growth comes the ability to grow dividends. And really, it's growth of dividends that are a key aspect in terms of our thought process, sustainability and growth. You know, there are opportunities elsewhere. We're often told the UK is cheap, and I can see that in terms of PE and so on. But it probably needs a bit of self-help. It needs some motivation to change. And that isn't the case in the US. The last thing to say, really, is the US has got a depth of opportunity that just isn't available in other markets. And, you know, it's the S&P 500, it's the Russell 2000. Within that, there's just a wide pool of opportunities. So if you really don't like one stock, there are probably several other stocks for you to consider without leaving that market. So the US is always going to feature prominently as a result of that, as just a source of opportunity, as a source of income growth. And really, that's where the earnings growth has been as well. So it's important. It's very important.
Thank you for that. And Will, how do you view the US as a market?
I think I'd just echo the point around the opportunity set in the US. You know, the depth, the liquidity, the valuation point and the yield point is often skewed, of course, by its predominance in the tech sector prominence in that space, where typically you don't get a dividend yield and the valuations look higher. And I think that sometimes leads some to overlook US equities when they're thinking about where you can get an income from. So I think the US can do a double job. One, it can help drive the growth and the dividend growth that my peers just talked about. But I think also you can dig down amongst those opportunities and you can find some really good dividend pairs. And I'm not talking about some of that high yielders that Mark referred to, but you know, your Coca-Cola's, your Lockheed Martin, Wisconsin Energy, American Tower. You know, these are good sort of low to mid single digit yielders with dividend growth there and some buybacks as well, because of course it's the US market. And so I think those are, you know, perfectly sensible businesses to have within an income fund.
Thank you for that, William McIntosh White, multi-asset investor at Rathbones. And thank you to John Moore, Senior Investment Manager at RBC Brewin Dolphin, and Mark Pedden, Global Equity Income Investor at Aegon. And thank you all for listening. Please do remember to tune in to future editions of the FT Advisor podcast. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.